Jody Denberg is program director of KGSR in Austin, Texas, and has been in the music scene for a long, long time, and has also had the pleasure of meeting and talking with Joni Mitchell. Jody, thanks for talking with us. I'm curious first to get your personal story of connecting with Joni's music as a listener, as a young man. Which album broke through to you for her as just a music fan?
As a music fan, the Joni Mitchell albums that broke through to me were two at the same time, Court and Spark and The Hissing of Summer Lawns. I got them both when I was about 15, and obviously they're the yin and the yang of the romantic relationships, Court and Spark being the idealized vision somewhat, and The Hissing of Summer Lawns, the emptiness of suburban life. So those were the two records that I first connected with by Joni.
All right, well, talk to me a little bit about that, if you can kind of go back into your 15-year-old mindset. You know, what does a 15-year-old boy listening to Court and Spark draw that's compelling from Joni Mitchell?
Well, I was having my first relationships. They weren't full-blown relationships, but having a girlfriend and things like that. And, of course, I did not have a deeper understanding of relationships. And then listening to Court and Spark, I started to realize the nuances and the depths of relationships, and that although Court and Spark is an idealized vision of romanticism, sometimes it also punctures a lot of the illusions. So it was kind of a light bulb moment for me, listening to Court and Spark, hearing what a woman thought about relationships, that not every relationship was perhaps the definitive monogamous marriage that would unfold for those people. And so that was a revelation to me. And I'd been listening to the Beatles my whole life, but the sound of Court and Spark, the layering of the vocals, the orchestration, the falsetto vocals, for lack of a better phrase, all of those things were new to me as a listener and were just these colors that I'd never heard in music before.
You said you know those albums inside out. I'm wondering if you could pick one song at a time and maybe pick a couple that, you know, have a compelling turn of phrase or something that, you know, really stands out for you.
From Court and Spark, when I looked back over the album recently, what really stood out to me was the song Down to You. I mean, just the first lines, everything comes and goes, marked by lovers and styles of clothes. I mean, lovers come, styles of clothes go. And just that line set the pace for that song and sort of was symbolic to me of the whole record. And then just the realization that no matter how many lovers you have, no matter how many people are in your life, that it all comes down to you. That's the bottom line. And that's a revelation for someone who's 15 years old. I think from Court and Spark, that's the song that sums it up for me. The thing about Court and Spark is that it is a piece. It is of a piece. It's kind of hard to separate out the songs, and many of them seg into the next. So, you know, I view Court and Spark as a complete piece. And then the other side of it, The Hissing of Summer Lawns, is not a complete piece. There's these African drums that break up one song, and a very stark song like Shadows and Light that ends the whole album. If I had to pick out something that was revelatory from The Hissing of Summer Lawns, for me, it was that Joni was undaunted. It did not matter, you know, that I found out in retrospect what a commercial success Court and Spark was, what a breakthrough it was, and that this record was in no way echoing Court and Spark. It tackled the political and the personal. It incorporated so many musical influences. And lyrically, if I had to pick out something, I think it was Edith and the Kingpin, because of its portrayal of 1970s decadence and how sad it was. There's that line, women he has taken grow old too soon. He tilts their tired faces gently to the spoon. That's sad. I mean, that is a sad, sad song, and yet maybe Joni's own Hotel California in a way.
And what you're describing, some people have pointed out, as is an evolution for Joni of moving from the very inward-focused confessional lyric to becoming more of an observer and matching, you know, that skill with her internal insight. And I always think of Hejira as an album that sort of completes that, and I'm wondering if you have some impressions of that record in that light.
Hejira, for me, is my favorite Joni Mitchell album. It's one of my top five albums of all time. And yes, it does combine the inward-looking lyricism with more of the observational lyrics, but it combines them in a way that they're almost inseparable. I mean, the picture that's painted in Song for Sharon is about Sharon, but it's just as much about the narrator as it is about Sharon, the person looking at Sharon and her domestic success, and yet the narrator in the song doesn't possess that. Hejira, sure, the narrator's I'm traveling in some vehicle, I'm sitting in some cafe, but then she moves away from that tight focus to listen, strains of Benny Goodman coming through the snow and the pine wood trees, which is more of a universal take, or even more universal. You know, I looked at the granite markers, those tributes to finality, to eternity. That's the universal, and then Joni brings it right back to, and then I looked at myself here, chicken scratching for my immortality. So Hejira combines both of those lyrical approaches, but in the most cohesive, focused way of Joni's career.
Your friend Sean Colvin has told me that if she had written one other song for herself, that it would have been Amelia. That's a really compelling track as well. Can you talk a little bit about what comes through on that one for you?
Yes. When I first heard Amelia, I did not even know who Amelia Earhart was. And one time I sat down with Joni for about an hour, and I told her, speaking of her in the third person, do you want to know what my favorite Joni Mitchell lyric is? And she, you know, said, yes, what? And I said, in Amelia, like me, she had a dream to fly. And there's so many different ways you can take that lyric. And to me, that's the central lyric in the whole song. Okay, yes, she had a dream to fly. She's Amelia Earhart. She wants to take to the sky. But she also had this dream that she wanted to be successful, that she wanted her dream to be successful. She wanted the dream to fly. And Amelia, again, the way it combines the personal and the universal, when she's up in that airplane and she's looking down, I'm trying to think of the exact line. Oh, it's the one that starts the song. I was driving across the burning desert. She spotted the six jet planes leaving six white vapor trails across the bleak terrain. She's looking at the sky. It was the hexagram of the heavens. It was the strings of my guitar. Well, she's taking this beautiful occurrence and turning it into a personal metaphor, and then turning it right back inside out again. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. There's a lot in Amelia that you can project into. It's one of those songs where there's plenty of spaces for the listener to put their own personal interpretation into, which makes a lot of sense since it's about Amelia Earhart in some ways, and about flying and about the sky. I think for me the most notable tracks on Hejira, besides the title track, Song for Sharon and Amelia, would have to be the final song, Refuge of the Roads. Obviously Joni's somebody who spent a lot of time on the road, but she doesn't make this a song about I'm traveling in my bus going from gig to gig. It's just about living a transient life and how that translates to the bigger picture in life. So I think Refuge of the Roads is another crucial track, along with Hejira, Amelia, and Song for Sharon. After Hejira, the album Don Juan's Reckless Daughter was the album where the world music influences that were on Hissing of Summer Lawns came more to the fore, more of the percussion, the African-American touches. As a matter of fact, on the album, isn't it Joni, who is in blackface, I believe, presenting herself as an African-American on one of the photographs? So that's the bridge, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter with the long extended pieces. And then that segs right into Mingus, where she takes the instrumental music of one of the all-time jazz greats and has the gumption to put her own lyrics to these songs, with Mingus's blessings, of course. But this is where she told the pop audience, if you want to take this ride with me, take this ride, fasten your seatbelts. If you don't want to take the ride, you can get off the train now.
Right. And then when she emerges into the 80s, There, it strikes me, and you know, go with this as you like, but it strikes me is that she's able to tap into, you know, all of these genres that she's explored, maybe more specifically in the particular albums, because then the albums seem to be, you know, a real amalgam, don't they?
Well, I hear Wild Things Run Fast not so much as a consolidation of things that had happened in the immediate past of Joni Mitchell's career, but more of a getting back to the things that she thought would be more relatable to more people. Obviously, at that point, she'd heard that she'd lost some of her audience. They weren't as interested in these experimental tracks. And on Wild Things Run Fast, she opens up immediately with the nostalgia of Chinese Cafe and Unchained Melody. Now, 25 years later, some of the production seems a bit dated. The hard rock attempts on some of these songs, the power chords. But this album also has a couple of Joni's best songs. The song Love, the song Moon at the Window especially. We're back to talking about what's inside Joni's heart and bringing it out with some melody. And something Joni has complained about to me in the interview I did is that the critics were always telling her she'd lost her sense of melody. And although she argued that point greatly about the albums like Mingus and the ones right before it, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, here she really does regain her footing in melody. The album that came after Wild Things Run Fast, Dog Eat Dog, a bit too didactic for me. The three great stimulants, artifice, brutality, and I can't even remember. But the three great stimulants, a lot of the music on Dog Eat Dog seemed just a little bit like someone in a Malibu mansion giving their vision of the world. And that's, I think, the hardest record for me to listen to, both lyrically as well as with the production, some of it by Thomas Dolby. Again, just sounding dated and not as timeless as even later records like Night Ride Home, which is over 15 years old now, still has a timeless feel to much of it.
I want to check this theory out with you since you've been in radio for so long. And I mean, you're a bit of a special case because you've worked for many years, you know, at a station that really does have an adventurous programming attitude. But it strikes me that, you know, Joni Mitchell through the early 70s and even up through mid 70s, her ability to be heard on FM radio started to close at about the same time that playlists started to close. I mean, granted that in the late 70s when she was doing very adventurous stuff, it might have been very challenging for any radio station. But then when she comes back in the 80s, she's not meeting the same FM radio market that would explore with her or play album cuts. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think the challenges that Joni Mitchell faced in getting on the radio in the 80s were the same faced by all of her peers. And I don't really think it's a function of Joni's adventurousness and then coming back to something more accessible. Whether you're Paul McCartney or James Taylor or Neil Young or any of the people that we would think of as Joni's peers, Bob Dylan even, that music was just not played on the radio to a great extent. So I don't think Joni being shut out of commercial radio is a function of her music so much as just the tightening of playlists, the focus on demographics, things like that.
Right. So that if artists in, you know, I know Paul Simon has often looked at, you know, some of his music as whether or not it's commercially successful, that means it's successful or not. But it always struck me that there's, you know, a lot of great music that's being made by these heritage artists that, you know, just isn't getting heard because of kind of the nature of the business in a way.
Well, it is the truth that a lot of great music being made by heritage artists is not being heard. But I think that's becoming less of a problem in the current day and age because there's other avenues besides radio to hear them. So if you're interested in hearing the new album by, and we'll take an example, Paul McCartney, Memory Almost Full, a solid album by a heritage artist. If you're interested in hearing that and you're not hearing it on the radio, you can go to your nearest coffee store, Starbucks, and purchase it there. Or listen to it online or watch the videos on YouTube, which makes it that much more interesting that Joni Mitchell has chosen the same path for her album, her new album, Shine. She's going to have those records in Starbucks where people that would respond to her music shop for coffee, and they're going to have the ability to pick it up. Paul McCartney's record has sold at this date 450,000 copies. 45% of those copies were sold in Starbucks. So although Joni and other heritage artists are being shut out of radio, there's so many other avenues now for their music to be exposed, whether it's late night television or the internet or other places, that I think that's less of a factor in making them successful. And when Paul McCartney sells 500,000 records, that's a lot of records. The biggest selling albums of 2007 thus far, just three or four of them have sold about 1.5 million records. So it's a very successful record.
Yeah. How does that compare with his Chaos and Creation?
Well, the sales for Chaos and Creation were similar to what Paul has right now. At this date, we're talking 450,000 units, but he toured behind that. He did so many things to bring it to light, and Memory Almost Full is still early in its shelf life.
Right, yeah. Could you, another one of the releases that I'm hoping to focus on is Night Ride Home, and you mentioned it briefly, but do you want to take a crack at putting that in the Pantheon perspective?
Well, I think Night Ride Home, again, by Joni, is an opportunity to connect with her earlier audience for some of the songs by bringing a greater sense of melody in play. The Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm album is another that I don't feel dated as well because of the use of the drum programming. But on Night Ride Home, let's just take the title track, beautiful melody, nice situation that most people can put themselves in, and a certain sweetness. And it was a real sweetness. It wasn't contrived. It was based on her relationship with her husband and co-producer Larry Klein. And that's the opening of the album, Night Ride Home. Now we go right into Passion Play, where Joni gets out her percussion again. I think it's Alex Acuna that does a lot of the percussion, and Larry Klein as well. So it's not as much easy listening, but she gives you a doorway to get into the record and to things like Cherokee Louise with its not always accessible vocal arrangements, or The Windfall, which is kind of tough to listen to as well. Slouching Towards Bethlehem, the Yeats poem that she puts to music. Some of those things are tough, but then she brings you back in with Come In From the Cold, which is just a beautiful piece of work. And so there's something for everybody on Night Ride Home. And I think that album, more than some others, consolidates her two approaches, at least from a production standpoint.
And then your, I guess, most recent interview with her is somewhat around this time. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
I interviewed Joni Mitchell one time, but it was at length in 1998 to coincide with the record Taming the Tiger. She liked to conduct her interviews, when she rarely did them, at the Hotel Bel Air. So we sat down there for an hour, and she couldn't have been more forthcoming. She chain-smoked the whole time, but told tales of mismanagement and dental problems and misperception in the media and by her audience. And she was just sweet enough to not come off bitter, but she certainly had her own ideas about where she fit into the world and the marketplace. And she was issuing an album at that time called Taming the Tiger. That was just a beautiful piece of work. Although it was somewhat overlooked, I remember Elvis Costello did a piece for Vanity Fair in which he listed his 500 favorite records or something like that. And that was one of the two Joni Mitchell records that he chose. That is just a beautiful, beautiful album. And like a lot of Joni's albums, it had a self-portrait on the cover that personalized it. So strong piece of work, 1998's Taming the Tiger.
How did your meeting her and conversation with her impact your experience of listening to her catalog of music? Did you notice anything shifting at all?
I've been blessed enough to meet most of the artists whose music I admire, and I learned a long time ago not to confuse the artist with the art. So when I met Joni Mitchell, it really didn't affect the way I hear her music and listen to her songs or hear her lyrics. I'd seen Joni portrayed in the media enough to know the kind of person that I was given a glimpse of. So meeting her and interviewing her did not affect the way I hear her music.
So in the time we have left here, let me cycle back around to get some impressions. Maybe, you know, these turn into your impressions as a music historian as much as anything, about, you know, going back and exploring Clouds and the landmark Blue, which are the two albums that I'm going to focus most closely on. What do you think of when you think of Joni Mitchell's second solo album, Clouds?
Well, when I found Clouds, because I grew up after that, I was listening to it in retrospect. I was struck by the innocence of Joni's voice, the higher pitch that she had back then, just the simpler way that she looked at the world, just as any 20-year-old looks at the world in a simpler fashion than when they're 30 or 40. So listening back to Clouds, I was just struck by, oh, this is where that person came from. This is where the art on Court and Spark germinated, on an album like Clouds. And then Blue, which many people hold up as their favorite Joni Mitchell album, was a continuation of Clouds. They could almost just be disc one and disc two in a two CD set. And again, the higher voice, the simpler arrangements, the stunning nakedness of Blue in its lyrical content. I don't know if anyone's ever been that naked on record before, except maybe in the fold-out of For the Roses, where Joni is literally naked on the cover.
And explore that a little bit more, just to underline it. When you're talking about naked in her lyricism, yeah.
Well, the nakedness of Blue, besides just the sparseness of the production, which I would compare to, say, John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band, there's not a note wasted. There's nothing extraneous on this record. And lyrically, it's the same way. You know, on the song River, it's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. There's not a word wasted there, not a drop. And then the nakedness of My Old Man, just the simple longing that she has in there for her companion. And I think the song that strikes me the most on the album is Little Green. Just seems so vulnerable. And for so many years, I didn't quite know, well, most of us did not know exactly what that song was about for, you know, 25, 30 years, whenever it was that we found out that Joni had given a child up for adoption and she reconciled with that daughter or reunited with that daughter. So the song, although it was sparse, again, left a lot of room for us to project our own emotions into that song. And thankfully, now that I know a little bit more about what that song's about, it hasn't lessened its expansiveness for me. But there's nothing wasted in there, just a little green, like the color when the spring is born. It's just, you can't improve upon Blue.
When you look at the Joni Mitchell website, they have a little survey of your favorite Joni Mitchell song, and A Case of You is on the top of that list, and I know that's particularly affecting for me. I'm wondering if you have a take on why that song is so compelling.
Well, as an amateur guitarist and singer, I like to play A Case of You on my guitar, and when you get inside of it, it's just, I mean, it starts out with the fact that, you know, this love affair is over just before our love got lost. So right off the bat, you know you're singing about something that's not there anymore, and we've all lost love, and we all know the sadness of that. And then the pictures that she paints on the back of a cartoon coaster in the blue TV screen light. We can all relate to these visions, even if we never sketched anything on the back of a cartoon coaster. The things in there are just, it's the bittersweetness of life, and it's reflected just like a glass of wine would be bitter and sweet. It's a great metaphor, but it doesn't play to the metaphor. It really plays to the emotion.
You know, you talked about her sort of innocence at 20 when she was writing the songs for Clouds. And the one line of hers that I think really keeps coming back to me about what she's so good at is the one from Both Sides Now, where she sings, you know, something's lost and something's gained in living every day. And, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about what she does so well, which is to hold both of these, sides. You said yin and yang before, talking about two albums, but both sides to humanity in a song or even a single line.
Joni told us something's lost and something's gained in living every day. And that's a truism, but it's good to hear that. It's good to have a reminder of that. And Joni's body of work reminds us of that. The romances that she's lost and lived through, some of them very public, so we know the partners that, or we imagine we know the partners she's singing about. Not only the romantic loss, but just the aging process. The amazing thing about Joni, even though she's putting out a new album, is if she hadn't chosen to put out a new album, with Travelogue, as well as the other album, Both Sides Now, she brings everything full circle, and she gives us the circle game again, and she gives us Both Sides Now again with the other side of the coin. She takes them from the songs of optimism and youth to being songs of knowledge and maturity. And that full circle of Joni's work is really symbolized well in Travelogue and Both Sides Now, the latter period works in which she revisits some of her earlier work.